Hi, John.
Hey, Alex.
Do you know what I hate?
What's that?
The country and people of Bhutan.
Really? Why this time?
Because they're all a bunch of multi-armed skeleton monsters.
All of them? Really?
Well, I mean, from the sample size that I saw, yes.
Well, there was that whole truckload of dudes.
Oh, yeah, and they're monks. I love monks. All right, so I take everything back. Anyway, we watched The Empty Man.
Empty is the hour before sleep kills you every night and pushes you to safety away from every kind of light. Empty is me.
Did we watch The Empty Man?
My tulpa did.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a very bizarre movie that,
yes.
And I know I've used that word a lot, but this is extremely strange and I love it exists. It should not exist. It was made by this guy, David Pryor, who like got his start making special features for DVDs, like stuff for David Fincher. And I think the first thing he did was for that movie Ravenous with like Guy Pearce.
So you're saying that was his prior work.
That was his prior work. Yes. And this movie,
I was just getting it out of the way, to be honest.
Yeah. Thank you. Because it had been in the back of my mind too. So I'm glad we just took care of it. But this movie is based on a comic series that the comic series, from what I understand happens, like the empty man virus, so to speak, has devastated the world or devastated America. And so it's kind of happens like in medias res or whatever. Whereas this kind of tones down some of the things in that book and makes it sort of a prequel, as it were. Although, okay. I don't even know if it's really related to it at all, other than sort of being based on ideas thought about by the people that made it. But it was initially shot in like 2016. There was just like, this was this guy's first like big movie. It was a comedy of errors in that way. They were shooting in South Africa for a long time. Then they had to do like the last 2 weeks in Chicago to do some exterior stuff, but there were some problems, like their costumes didn't make it on time, but the studio was like, no, you got to finish because otherwise some tax rebate in South Africa is going to go away. Meanwhile, this one executive that had been shepherding them along, who was a huge fan of the idea, like would be in there giving notes, and the next day, boom, he's gone because of a merger between, like basically when Disney started owning Fox, this guy went away. And whoever came in afterwards was like, what the fuck is this crap? Cut it down. They they rushed to do some test screenings. The test screenings were terrible. Then the studio like did it's like a 90-minute cut of this, which I can't even fathom what that was like. Did even worse. So they were like, well, I guess finish it the way you want to finish it. So this movie should not exist, and it's amazing that it does.
It really is. This is not at all what I was expecting.
Yes, and there was the ad campaign, because the way they just dumped it in the theaters, and the ad campaign made it look much more like a teen slasher movie.
Yeah, I was expecting a Candyman kind of thing, which, you know, a lot of the visuals and there's reference to it. But boy, yeah. This movie is not about that at all.
No. It's like three different movies jammed into one.
Yeah. I mean, and it's aware of that. Like, so it starts off with the 3 days in Bhutan and then gives you the title card, then starts the movie. But those 3 days in Bhutan is what, 15 minutes?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
a while.
Yeah. It's, and I'm a sucker for that in movies. Like, The one that immediately comes to mind is Raising Arizona. That's like a good like 15 minutes before the title card even shows up.
Let's quickly go over the Bhutan movie. Mm-hmm. Here's some things that annoyed me is I made a point of going, you know what, Alex, what you're going to do is remember all the characters' names this time.
Oh, yeah. Good luck.
Because I was expecting them to be characters in it. There's a guy named Paul, and that's the only one I remember right now. But still, the point is I was going to remember them all. Until the title card and went, oh, motherfucker.
Yeah.
And then I tried to wipe my hand away. But let me tell you something. That fucking falling into a chasm because you hear the call of a whistle and finding a crazy multi-armed, like weird Hindu monster skeleton is about the coolest thing that's ever happened in
yes.
a movie.
And that creature design is so rad.
It's really, really good.
Yeah. And I also like that this first section is a little bit more like more of a teen kind of slasher movie because like all the people in it are very pretty compared to the rest of the movie. And no offense to people in the rest of the movie. They're fine. James Badge Dale in particular is a very handsome man. But like they have that very much like teen horror movie look to them. And I like that kind of twist, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. So in the Bhutan part, here's the only thing I didn't understand. Okay. Well, there's some stuff I want to reference. I was so proud of myself in this movie that I caught a couple of things. And I'm going to, as we go on, I might point them out. And then when the discovery happens, I just want to point out how dumb I am. But when they're walking by the prayer wheels, I was like, oh, I got to make sure I pay attention to who spun the prayer wheel. Because I bet you those are either cursed or they're blessed. And then at the end, there's like one person left alive and they've got like dead eyes. You're like, oh, okay. You know, probably wasn't the prayer wheel. Didn't need to pay. But that spinning something in the center frame repeats over the movie. And I'm like, oh, I'm picking up on something. This is smart. But yeah. I want to get into it now because I have a whole thing.
Yeah. Later. Well, and I can't stress this enough. And we've done this with other movies, but like, if you want to hear about this movie, you want to hear us talk about it, like really watch it first. It is almost 2.5 hours long. It is a chunk of time. It's on HBO Max right now. But like this is a movie that to me is so much more of an experience than I do think it's confusing and messy. And I do think there's threads that you can pull on and you know, get the whole story here. But it really is kind of like The Shining, where it's like you can make these weird connections, you know, Room 237 about it. But it's really kind of meant to just sort of be experienced. Yeah. And so, definitely do that. But it's...
I'm on your page. Like, stop listening to this right now and watch the movie. Because I am of a... I'll listen to a movie podcast before seeing the movie or not seeing the movie at all. In this case, if you're at all curious, definitely watch this movie first because we're going to spoil the shit out of it. And even that's probably a bit of a spoiler, saying there's things to be spoiled. But all right. So if you touch me, you'll die.
Yes.
No, I'm just warning you.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That doesn't come back up in the movie, does it?
Don't touch Willie. Good advice.
Yeah.
Not really. Because when she's clipping his beard, Amanda is clipping his beard and I was like, oh wait, she's touching him. But I think, I'm not real clear on what happened there. If it's something that literal, or if he just knew like something's going on here, leave me alone and couldn't, you know.
I mean, let's say we don't have to go through them because they're not part of the movie, but they basically have nothing to do with the rest of the movie other than this was another empty man scenario.
Other than like what happens at the very end.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
But there is little other tells in it because like there's a part when
the wiki.
Well, the wiki, but like when James is in the Pontifex Institute thing. And like he walks by a painting of that cabin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because also in his apartment, there's pictures of him on a snowy, like mountain climby kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's a thing with like the husband, Amanda's dad. That same thing that I like thought like, oh my God, is that Paul? But it's totally not. It's
well, okay. So that's what I was trying to figure. Okay. I mean, not trying to figure. I think I got it. But like, so that whole thing ends. They do the title card. It starts off, and we see who's the lead? James. You see James jogging and smoking, which I love, but, and I don't mean to be racist here, but he's a handsome square jawed white guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, is that Paul? I mean, did he change his name? Like I'm face blind to handsome white guy. They're, you know, like they just, that could be the same person.
Well, clearly, in the beginning, like it's from a distance or something. It's like, well,
yeah.
What a year it's been since I've committed murder with my friend.
And I was kind of like going through my head of like, that was one of the theories. I was like, is he... just did he come back and like his brain got fucked up and now he's this he works at a security firm
which I've never seen from what I can tell anyway. I don't think I've seen this actor before, and I see that he's been in stuff and it's all just movies I haven't watched, like 13 hours. He's in The Departed, I guess. I don't remember his character, but he's very much like, he looks like Action Joe. Like, you know, he should be in these and absolutely be in Michael Bay movies.
Well, he's in Iron Man 3, so I definitely seen him in that.
But
he's in your favorite movie, The Lone Ranger.
Oh, damn. Really? How did I miss that? I was probably just too enthralled with Johnny Depp. And I think I think the casting was very smart as well, because that kind of, you know, gruff, masculine dude but he's also very like vulnerable. I don't know. It works very well. The whole thing, by the way, this whole movie very much reminds me of stories by Laird Barron. He's a weird fiction writer, and so much of his shit, although I kind of like it, so much of his shit is like, so he smoked a cigarette and drank his booze while he was looking cool, and then some weird Lovecraftian stuff happened, and then he drank and smoked some more. And it's like, that kind of really, really like, like trying to be cool and noir-y sort of thing.
Well, I was going to say, I was going to get to it later, but I'll bring it up now. I think Laird Barron is a mispronunciation of Alex Boland, because if you think about Periphery, this movie has a fuckload of overlay on Periphery.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted you to watch it.
Yeah, because, like, oh, it's a weird pixie girl in, like, a Victorian dress introduces the action when he finds out that there's, like, another world operating. His name is La Sombra, which I thought was the dream. Apparently, it's the shadow.
Right.
Either way, this movie doesn't – it's not the same as Periphery, but Jesus Christ, there is a lot but in common to the point that, like, I feel like I should get, like, not story by credit, but I should get, like, themes by credit.
It swims in the same waters, to be sure.
But that was – so one of the reasons I was – we'll get – well, obviously, we'll get to the what happens at the end of it later. But one of the reasons I was kind of tricked by it is the his name there, like, all of the town names are, like, weird literary references.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, this is like a book or something. Like, he's like a writer. Or like, this is like, I always went down this writer path because it's so close to Periphery that I'm like, oh, and I wrote that book. So like my head went, I'm like, I picked up on every clue they laid. I was like, oh, this is Periphery. Like you just, yeah. Like, it's the same thing I did in that book with like, I hid names of things that should reference something that like helps you with it. Mm-hmm. And like this layer upon layer. So I picked up every fucking clue this movie laid down, except it took me to a completely wrong conclusion.
Yeah.
And it was so annoying because I'm like, dude, I picked up on so many fucking hints and my dumb brain went the wrong way.
Well, I was reading an interview with the director where he said that like himself, he's like, I can see three different interpretations of this whole thing, but there's probably more, you know, that I'll let people kind of figure that out. It's not the Neil Breen, like, I don't know why the doll heads are in the desert. You figure it out. It's a very thoughtful ambiguity that does leave some stuff open for interpretations and questions. My personal favorite, cause I don't think I didn't pick up on nearly all the literary stuff you do, is the name of the high school.
Oh, Jacques Derrida.
Yeah. And he was saying that it was originally Derrida High School, but he decided, he's like, no, I really want to underline this point. So I'm going to call it the Jacques Derrida High School. And the lawyers were like, I don't know if we have clearance to use that name. Like, there's that's like funny. A Tony Derrida that's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So Jacques Derrida, all I know about him is that he's like some philosopher guy and he's incredibly hard to read. So like, I don't know. All I know is like, but I saw that in the background. I'm like, oh, that means something. Like if I got obsessed with this movie, there's information there.
Well, his whole thing, like what little I know about him, he's a big deconstructionist, which makes sense for this movie or some of the themes of this movie.
I mean, some of the other stuff I picked up on is pretty obvious. Like when they're looking at the map, all the names on the map are like super like hinty. Like there's a Mark Twain Forest who is somebody with a different name and created an identity. There's just a bunch of shit like that where it's like, oh, I've all these hints feeding into my head. And that's what I do with Periphery. I'm like, oh, I know what this guy's doing. He's just using a name that references something else to get people in the mindset.
We can get to that later, but just that I missed all those names because I was just totally thrilled at that map effect when it zooms into the map and then goes actually into the
That was nice.
I thought that was so cool. And you could tell, like, that had a very David Fincher feel. So when I found out later that this guy worked with Fincher a lot, then I'm like, well, that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah, there is some Fincher in this.
Yeah.
Now that you say that.
But it's nice because it's not one of those things where there was some speculation when George Clooney made Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. People are like, Steven Soderbergh basically directed that movie because it feels very much like a Soderbergh movie.
Mm.
Where this, like, you can get the sense of, yeah, you can tell that he worked with Fincher like that. But he's not just aping him. You know, he's doing his own
shit. No. It doesn't feel like a Fincher movie, but now that you bring up Fincher, I'm like, oh, I can see that's there. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a suisson of it.
Yeah.
I need to word this because I'm not being gross Alex here. I'm genuinely curious. So the second part of the movie basically kicks off in for real when his daughter is in his backyard. I think, or is whatever, whoever Amanda is.
Yeah. The daughter of
Yeah. When they're sitting on the bench together, mm-hmm. It felt like there was sexual tension there.
Well, there's...
Is that the way it's shot? Or, like, why did I pick up... Like, there's something there, and I'm not just trying to be, like, inflammatory like I normally do. Like, I'm genuinely curious where this comes from, because I don't know if it's the angle, but it felt like they were going to kiss. No, like, the whole fucking scene.
There is a tenderness between them that is sort of explained later, but even then, in their second interaction at the end, she's very strange in that. Like there's bits where like she's almost crying and it feels it's kind of hard to wrap your head around with the other revelations that are going on. And you're like, well, why would that be the case? Why are you feeling like that? So you're trying to put it all together. But yeah, particularly on subsequent viewings, there's an uncomfortableness there. For me as the viewer, because it does feel like, is there something going on between these people? But there's definitely more than just you're a buddy of mine. I know you. It felt there's layers going on there.
Yeah, it was just interesting because I guess she's a good actress, so I mean that might be that. But like, it's just like the way it was shot, like over the shoulder, and then the way they're in frame, it's just like, oh, there's a lot here. I guess I watch a lot of shitty movies, so maybe just watching a well framed like nice thing is just like, oh wow, this is getting me horny.
I love composition. Yeah. But I guess he initially wanted more of a like Laura Palmer All American Girl kind of thing, but then he saw this person's like headshot and was intrigued, and then like her audition tape, he was like, boom, that's it, we're doing that.
Oh, she's great. Like, yeah, I have a point somewhere
fantastic.
I made a point somewhere in here that like I think this we're gonna see this actress for the rest of our life.
I think she's great, so good. And like, I mean, yeah, some of it, like her particular look in this with the strange like mushroom haircut and whatever, I think serves this well, but I also just think she did a very good job.
Yeah, she really won me over. It's one of those like, oh, I hope this, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if she's just, because she's beautiful, but she's not, that's not important in this movie. So I'm like, oh, I could see this one of those, like kind of the next movie in, she could be like she reminds me of like an Anne Hathaway type, not with, you know, not like, Anne, yeah, but that thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I pick up what you're saying.
I liked it. So when we meet her, I kind of want to watch this again because there's so much shit that was great, but like, she's talking about like NLP, like neuro-linguistic programming, and like how, like, it, you know, how you create your own reality.
Yeah. The power
and, like,
of positive
it sounds thinking. Like she's just being like weird and like being like, you know, the secret or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, but has then later when the movie gets, you're like, oh fuck. Oh, again, it's so, I'm sorry. I'm not going to keep comparing this to my books, but that's what I did with Periphery, where if you read it again, I gave away so much shit in the first couple chapters, but you had no fucking ability. Right. There's no ability for you to have known what I was telling you. And this was one of those where it's like, oh, motherfucker, you laid it out bare in like the first scene.
This movie does absolutely reward repeat viewings. There is some of it where it's like you start thinking about it too much and like some like stuff doesn't necessarily make sense. But I don't think that's a bad thing. Because you are experiencing this movie alongside of the main character, and he's like, so when there's stuff that doesn't exactly put together the way this movie kind of plays out, it makes sense that it doesn't make sense if that is any kind of coherent thought. But
yeah, I would
it's
love
also
to watch
again, like I said, like it's not something that I think you're meant to be pulling at all the individual threads at that hard.
Well, no, it's the idea is purposely not confusing, but like it's perfectly like that. I mean, so you can't have something that can be read three ways and have it be that you can pull on the threads of every way. Just that's not the way writing works. I would like to see this again. However, I would say this, and I guess I'm asking you because you've seen it three times. I feel like I have no desire, even though I very much enjoyed it the first time, I have no desire to sit through the Bhutan part again.
It's great. I actually liked it significantly more in later viewings. It goes by a lot quicker too, I think.
Maybe that might be true.
what to expect. But I understand your desire to just be like, yeah, I got it.
Love the monster. I like the monster skeleton. Like, I'll totally like fast forward and watch him hang out. But like, yeah.
I still think it's great.
One of the weird things, the layout of this movie, is it goes day one, day two, day three,
right,
in Bhutan. Then goes to fast forward 15 years. 25 years?
It's some years. I forget the
25 years. It's 1995. So that's 25 years. Okay. Oh my God, that makes me feel old.
Yeah.
And then we're in current day and it starts on day one again. But motherfucker, a lot happens in, like, multiple days happen in day one, I feel like.
There's a lot that goes down, but I think day one doesn't really happen until I think like the days are happening for different people, but I think like the big day one for him doesn't happen until later.
Day one comes on screen when the empty man made me do it in the bedroom, or it's shortly before there, where it shows day one on screen for that deal.
Because it's also in that day one, there's flashbacks to Amanda's story, or I'm sorry, to Devara's story about like Amanda and that. Some nighttime stuff. So yeah, the timeline does get a little fuzzy there. So I couldn't specifically speak to that because I don't recall.
So we find out, yeah, Blood and Mirror said the empty man made me do it. And the story now picks up on James used to be an undercover cop, works as a security firm now. And he's trying to find out what happened to Amanda.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the daughter of his dead best friend or close friend, and there's obviously something going on with the wife. We later find out they had a little, well, yeah, let's just go with it this way. Yeah. We found out they had a bit of a dalliance when he was younger, and we found out over the course of these flashbacks, he keeps seeing these hearing "Where were you?" whispered, and we find out through the course of these flashbacks and him kind of freaking the fuck out that he was going to Bone Town with Amanda's mom while his wife and son died in a horrible car accident.
Yes,
which I mean, I get it. Totally good reason to have guilt. Mm-hmm. That's going to fuck you up. However, I mean, if you were sitting on the couch watching football, there's nothing you could have done. It doesn't matter. I mean, I get that it'd make you feel worse, but like the fact is you weren't going to be in the car with you.
Right. But I think it's that you were doing like the worst possible thing you could do in the context of a marriage. Well, I suppose the worst thing you could murder, but you know, like,
absolutely. Yeah. I'm just 100%, but it's just one of those, like, you know, I mean, it's not like, well, God damn it, I'll drive him home myself if you're too busy at work. Wink.
Right.
It's just, you know, I mean, maybe that's the backstory, but anyway, I like how that's revealed slowly, that it's, there's just a weird tension between them, and then long and long and long. And then by the time you actually figure that out, it's about 5 minutes before you're like, oh, maybe not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's this movie, I don't want to say red herrings, but this movie like sends you down a lot of paths that you can decide to go down and really focus on, but then you kind of miss some other stuff.
Yeah.
Amanda's gone missing and she's left a note in blood, or there's a note in blood on the bathroom that says, "The empty man made me do it." And so James is like, "Hey, you know what? I'll go try to find your daughter, who I also care about, potentially in a creepy way." And in doing so, interviews her friend Devara, and you get this backstory about them summoning the empty man on a bridge.
Which I just gotta say, I love the interaction of kids, and it's written like actual teenagers, yes, not movie teenagers.
Yeah.
Because, like, the guy and a girl come up from the sewer, and then Devara makes "You were just blowing him underneath," and they both have the like look of like, yeah, that's totally what was going on under there. You always get teens written in such a like a dumb, either everything's hypersexual or everything's like, it's just, but this is actually just like, no, that's, I mean.
But no, I do like that, because there's a part, because the whole gimmick you learn with the empty man is that, like, if you're on a bridge and you find an empty bottle, if you blow across the top of it and focus your thoughts, you can summon him. And like on the first day you hear him, the second day you see him, and on the third day he comes to you or something like that.
Yes.
But you can't stop thinking about him. And it's kind of like Candyman, where she kind of dares them to do it, and they all sort of do it. Amanda dares them to do it, and the other do it. Devara is very much like, yeah, whatever. I don't really believe in this. But then they start to hear something on the bridge, and this is something that, in theory, would have made me angry, or in a different movie would have made me angry, where one of the kids like tries like, hey, stop fucking with us, or you know, tries to have some bravado, and this other kid is like, yeah, that'll fucking do it. That instead of being some like, you know, we need dialogue, that's like, no, that's actually what a teenager would say. Yeah. Like, would you just be like, yeah, way to go, idiot.
No, I actually like that line. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
I got a kick out of that.
There's the other creepy, when Devara is telling the story, they'll cut back to her in the car with James. And I like how she sees the weird cloak figure running at the car. There's that creepy part where like, there's like a bunch of kids sitting in like full Lotus, like just being like fucking creepos. Yeah.
There's a lot of just unsettling imagery in this, and I like that a lot. A lot of uncanny stuff, which is definitely more my style of horror, my preferred kind. So at this point, he hears this story, and so it kind of seems like it's like Candyman, basically. And in a way, at this point in the movie, it sort of is. He inexplicably gets a nosebleed around here. But then, like, you do get later on Devara, like, in a steam room at the gym. It's like, it's not explained where she is or why she is there, but it's like fancy gym spa kind of thing. And, she sees the empty man in the steam, and he murders her with scissors, but then like it pulls out to reveal it's herself stabbing herself in the face.
Yeah. So
it's just raises more questions.
Here's the part I didn't like about that is it's established there in high school and you see full frontal. I get they're legal or whatever, but like I don't need, like, make the fog cover. I don't need to see 18-year-old titties. I know I'm going against character here, but honestly, that made me uncomfortable and it kind of felt dirty. So we hear the story of that. James is looking for people and he's interviewing friends and he can't seem to find any of Amanda's friends.
Yeah. Which I'm a sucker for this too. Like, at horror movies in particular like this, where like doing research and like looking through microfiche and that kind of thing.
Yes.
And this movie has one of the few like looking at Wikipedia pages scenes that I actually really enjoyed.
Yeah, I like a research thing. I like a building the bag, for, you know, like, oh, okay, I need a gun and me get, and that really goes nowhere. But like, I'm a sucker for that. The gearing up sequence, I'm a sucker for.
But yeah, like
gearing up and research.
The I just rewatched Gore Verbinski's The Ring recently, the remake of the Japanese movie. There's a whole scene of her being in the newspaper archives looking at stuff. And I don't know. I'm always a sucker for that kind of stuff. Because particularly with the older movies where it's not just going on Wikipedia. But like I said, I think this movie did that pretty well.
Yeah. While he's looking for friends, eventually gets led into one of the houses and he sees on her wall this trippy black poster. But then the more you look at it, there's like things moving in it, and it's creepy and weird and very much like the book Periphery by Alex Boland, available on Amazon.com. Alex Boland, Alex Boland 2X's. All right, so before we move on, let's be very cautious here. Alex, A-L-E-X-X, B-O-L-L-E-N. No, but this is going somewhere. Patreon.com/AlexBoland. John has taken up the reins and doing some solo reviews of his October horror watches. So if you're interested in hearing the one that knows anything about movies talk, you sign up for the Patreon. I think it's $5 and up. You get every bonus episode we've ever done and a bunch of bonus shit I did. And I think all of my books are there in PDF. So if you're curious about me prattling on about Periphery, sign up for the Patreon. Just download everything and then cancel. I don't care. But the point is, John's doing solo things on there, and you should go listen.
Yeah. Listen to what he said.
And with witty banter like that, how would you not want to listen to John talk? I know, it's uncomfortable to fucking sell yourself, right?
No, not half as uncomfortable as recording a podcast by yourself. I mean, I don't need to tell you, but that is...
Yeah, it's a whole thing.
That is awkward, which, you know, big credit to a friend of the show, Steph Infection, and her show TMI Tuesday, because she does it, and like it's like a conversation with her. It's great. Good job, Steph.
So he finds... So he's like, all right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to check out the scene of the crime. I'm going to go to the bridge. And fucking asshole blows into a bottle when he's on the bridge. So let me, here's the thing, John. I don't care if you don't believe in something. Don't do that. Don't, like, if you're like, oh, here, if you rub this magic Buddha's belly, your mom dies. Like, I don't care. If you're 100% sure that's not going to happen.
Have you never, you know, it's also 100% sure. Bloody Mary into a mirror.
Yeah, but that the stories of that where they would just scare the shit out of you. This is specifically people are going to die.
Right.
It's like this is like the entire point of this experiment is you die. It's not, oh, you get a little freaked out, you know, Bloody Mary. But like Bloody Mary is you're supposed to say five times and she appears behind you.
Right.
Not she murders you violently.
But Candyman does. And it's still.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say Candyman into it.
I have. There's something in the abyss that calls out to me and makes me say Candyman.
Yes, but here's the difference. I'm not a dumb asshole.
Yeah, but that's kind of that works into the point of the movie, though. Being
also,
a dumb asshole.
I'm totally dumb asshole. I'm probably have said Candyman into a mirror. It's just, for me, if there's dead people, like, it's not like you said Candyman after your friend that said Candyman into a mirror died from bees. You probably wouldn't do it.
The idea, though, was that you had to, like, focus your thoughts. So maybe he was just like, he went, whoo, and then went, find Amanda. Beating the empty man at his own game.
Oh, yeah.
Which
but also, you still die in 3 days.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, the point is, that's dumb. So he's like, oh, I'll investigate where in that story that 16-year-old girl was blowing her friend. I'll go check that out. And he goes into the tunnel, and in a very effective and very much I didn't see it coming sequence, all of the friends we just met are hanging dead under the bridge and have been hanging there for, you know, more than an hour. Like, they look bloated.
And they, like, I think this movie does a great job with jump scares. And that is a very easy chance to just be like, bah! and it has that effect, but it doesn't really underline it that way.
You're right. And I hate a jump scare. Yeah. This movie, I think, had like one, maybe two that annoyed me. But for the most part, it's like I find that to be an appropriate scare.
Yeah,
it's,
I think
it's a sudden scare.
I think mainly
it's not
they
a jump
were like
scare.
The empty man coming at you, like when it comes to Devorah on the screen. But like this, for being a first time filmmaker, this guy's really confident in what he's doing, and I think that shows that he's willing, and he like has respect enough for the audience, because he's making a weird ass movie and he's not trying to hold your hand too much through it. You know what I mean? Like there's, like I said, there's clues and all this stuff, but there's not like, this is what this means, everybody. Okay. I want to make sure you get that before we move on to the next thing. And I think this was definitely a case of that where it's could easily have just been like a really cheap jump scare. And it's still, it gets you, but it's not, there's not like a violin sting that goes along with it.
Yeah. It's not a jump scare. It's a sudden scare, which is to me a very different, but yeah, totally effective. Really great. The cops show up, he's talking to them, and there's this wonderful scene between him and I don't know if he's been in other stuff, but I love the black older cop.
The actor's name is Ron Canada, as Detective Villers. And he's a character actor that's been in a bunch of stuff.
He's got a great character actor face, great character actor voice, but he's been in the movie earlier, but like they have this conversation and he's like, well, here's the thing. A few months ago in, I don't know, Iowa, whatever, one of the states that doesn't matter. He's like, Missouri. Perfect. Kansas. So, he's like, there's his mother who, fed her baby to the dogs and the empty man message was written on the walls. Here's the thing. There's cases like this. You're not going to solve. They're just like forces of nature. And he gives a speech of just like, there's almost like this awareness of like, he knows about Freddy or something.
Yeah.
Or just like, we know the just weird shit like this happens. It's like, you can't chase this. There's nothing to be done about this. These people don't know each other. They're unrelated. It's just, sometimes people fucking die and empty man is written on the wall.
Yeah,
you just got to deal with that.
He says, we can't indict the cosmos.
Oh, beautiful line. Yeah, yes.
I love it. And while that's happening, I like, cause that's intercut with a vigil for the teens that died. And I just, I don't know. I like that. While this story about this guy searching for this girl, that there is, it does remind you of the larger elements outside of this, the town and whatever. And I just thought that was a very well put together scene.
Yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. This movie does a good job of like giving life to the everything and not just our lead or whatever. Like it feels like a lived in world.
Yeah. And not that like I'm imbuing this with any meaning, but it is an interesting parallel of a group of people with flames mirroring what happens later with a group of people and a flame. You know what I mean? Like not necessarily deep meaning other than sort of the repetition. And that's a reoccurring theme with this movie in terms of shots, in terms of, you know, scene beats, whatever. But also I think, and I can't stress this enough, I like the sound design and the soundtrack to this movie so much. And it really works as like this really minimalist score that is very creepy, but also plays into the whole theme of the whole thing with the repetition and all that.
Cause this movie easily could have had one of those, the things that you hate where like they slow down a song from the '80s and try to make it creepy and they don't have that. Like, but this so easily, like this studio interference could have easily shoved like a slow Tears for Fears in this,
which I saw a trailer for the new, Edgar Wright movie that's coming out last night in Soho. And it has one of those, but it's a character in the movie singing it. So I'm like, well, okay. You know, whatever.
I'll at least give it a chance in that case.
Yeah, I'll go see it.
Oh, so yeah. All right, the other thing that happens on day one is he looks into Pontifax in the Wikipedia thing we're referencing before. But I just noticed that like I didn't slow down on it, but like he references that it's referenced on that page that they're in Bhutan and that six died in a cult experiment gone wrong. And they show these like creepy dudes in a cabin or like outside. Like, so there's a lot, like, I think if you get like weirdly obsessed with this movie, which there probably are a bunch of people that are, you could scour that. And yeah.
Yes, I did pause it. And I did notice, cause I didn't put this together the first time that, and you'll probably get a kick out of this. Stephen Root's character is Arthur Parsons.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I figured you would enjoy the Parsons joke, but yeah, there's beyond just the stuff you can read, there's little blurbs, you get little like hints of other stuff. And it's very effective as like deepening the lore of the Pontifex group, as it is, but just like as a scene of like to deliver information, it's done very briskly. It's funny because the guy, the James Pryor was talking about how he hates like movies that have like fake search engines and stuff like that. I always get a kick out of like getting around the copyright of those, something like that. Like my sister watches a lot of, Young and the Restless still, and I think they look at stuff on like YouView. And I like the weird bootleg names of these things. But they're like, but we couldn't show Wikipedia, but it absolutely, you can tell it's Wikipedia. Because the font, the spacing, whatever.
In the trivia, they said like some of those articles are just lifted from Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the only other thing that really happens in day two is or day one, the Amanda's mom comes to his house. It furthers the thing we talked about, how they have a past or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up at night because he hears something.
Yeah, so this is 3:03 a.m.
So, and he wakes up in long thermal pajamas.
Yes.
And a long top. And John, I have a question for you. You a union suit guy? You strike me as like a union suit kind of guy.
No. I'm flattered. No, in the winter when it's cold enough, I will wear long underwear. But generally, like, I'm not a pajamas guy, really.
Yeah. See, I imagine you in like red union suit, kind of like Finn from Finn and Jake.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just find it like, especially on holidays, you love pooping through a flap.
Well, okay. Now that you don't have to have a union suit to poop through a flap. Any clothes you can add a flap to, or just I travel with a flap.
Oh, that's why you picked up sewing.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, I don't sleep in a union suit. It's just pumps, red pumps. That's what I like to sleep in.
Gural, day two. He goes to Pontifex. He finds an info wheel of cards and spins it like the laundry and prayer wheels earlier in this movie. I made that point because I was so happy that this movie is doing interesting, fun things.
Yeah, I never put that together.
There's a bunch of spinning things right before. Yeah, yeah. And then he looks at this questionnaire and it's filled with weird, like, eschatology shit of, like, humanity is a disease. Society needs to be destroyed.
Yeah, yeah,
or if it doesn't fall, it doesn't exist.
If it fell, it served its purpose. Or I like the thing, like, can a brain itch? And I guess he recreated all those in After Effects because there were so many typos on the printed sheets.
Oh, that's funny.
That just makes me happy for whatever reason. But
really quick. Eschatology is the study of the end of the world. I used a very poncy word right there, and I try not to do that and then not explain it. But like, that's like a poncy word and I want to explain it. That's it. Let's continue.
That's good, because I didn't actually know what it meant.
Well, sometimes you want to immanentize the eschaton.
Mm-hmm.
There's like seven people in the audience who are like, yeah, fuck yeah, Alex. I'm not going to explain what that is, but like, they're like super happy. They're like, fnjord.
I'm very again, happy
super,
for them.
Excited. Don't worry about it. Yeah, yeah. Hail Iris.
But
okay, so.
But this has a very Scientology feel to it.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, no, it's subtle. Yeah. But
wait, you mean like them being like this old ass building that's multi floors that there's obviously a shitload of money, like the exact building that's in Portland, Oregon right now.
Yeah, and it has and you have to fill out a questionnaire about like your feelings and whether or not you're a psychopath.
I don't see any difference. And legally, if anybody's listening, I definitely don't. And John said that I would like to be in your movie.
But this is and you get a I'm on here because he has found she had a flyer in her room for the Pontifex.
The Pontifex. Yeah. Also, the other girl that he saw, the black poster, had a Pontifex reference.
Do you know what Pontifex
means? Pontifex is something to do with the Pope, right?
Well, there's a Catholic thing to it, but Pontifex basically means like bridge builders.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. But it's something popey, right?
There is a Catholic. I mean, like Pontiff is like another name for the Pope.
But I think that's what I'm thinking of. No, I was thinking of Pontiff. That's okay. Yeah,
but it is, it's Bridge Builders. And I guess the restaurant he's at the very beginning, the name is like Spanish for bridge.
Oh.
There's a lot of reoccurring bridge themes in this for good reason.
Because he had all that dental work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, this is floss, totally everybody. That's the message of this movie. Don't floss.
Stephen Root, root canal.
I am anti-vax about flossing. I am like, that's big dental trying to pull one over on you.
You know, John, I'm sorry. I know you're kidding, but I actually did read that like there's no like peer-reviewed scientific evidence that flossing does anything more than brushing your teeth. Like if you look at the mouths of flossers and the mouths of brushers and the equal amount of brushing per day, you know, if you brush three times a day and floss, brush three times a day and don't floss, there's no discernible difference with plaque buildup, et cetera.
Well, here's the truth of it, is that I just don't like flossing. And so rather than me admitting any kind of failure, it's a worldwide conspiracy. I did used to host pub quiz, and I had a regular team at one of my venues that was like dental students. And I kept bringing up how they said it was okay to not floss, and they would get so mad at me. So, you know, if you want to know who secretly runs things, see who you aren't allowed to criticize.
This is dental true. Students. Also, let's keep in mind that this is some dumb thing I read one time.
Yeah.
And probably not true.
I'm sure it's not true. But I don't like to floss. It's dumb.
John, did you know that there is only the great binding of the nothingness of things?
Yes.
And that this message comes to you from the empty man?
Directly from the empty man.
I was not expecting Stephen Root in this movie.
No.
And anytime Stephen Root shows up in a movie, I know I'm in good hands.
Yeah.
And he is... I never would have thought, oh, I'll cast Stephen Root in this part. And then watching him perform it, there was no one else that should be that guy.
Absolutely. And yeah. I guess he basically got off a plane to South Africa, went and did this, and then boom, done, left.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like just killed it. Yeah, he's absolutely great. And he's a guy, I think I first encountered him on news radio in the 90s, that NBC show. He was the boss. And I always thought he was funny, and then he's great on King of the Hill, whatever, and was great in these comedy roles.
Oh, jeez. That is Stephen Root, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I never, put it together. See, I know him from Office Space, obviously, but mm-hmm. he was on True Blood for a little run.
You've been watching Barry, haven't you?
I watched the first two seasons. I don't know how many
there's only been two. He is okay, so
yes,
great on that
show. Okay,
yes, I watched
all of Barry. Yes, he is
And it's like conniving and evil and like, yeah, he's a fantastic character actor. And you're absolutely right. When you see him, you know, you're like, all right, this is going to at least be good. If anything else, this is going to be great. And his speech here, to me, rivals Shea Whigham in True Detective. Second episode of True Detective, when they go, the season one, where they go to a tent revival. And the preacher's giving a speech, and the director or the producer of the show, someone, released a full cut of him just doing this, doing a little sermon. And it's amazing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm ready to convert. Yeah. He's great. But this was, yeah, it's very much like I've done a bunch of corporate videos in my time, and I've seen or heard salesmen talk, and you realize about halfway through, they're not saying anything at all, but they're very good at it. So you can, you know, like, oh, okay. Yeah. This sounds like, and so a lot of what he's saying is nonsense, but you're also like, it sounds like something, but it also is about how everything he's saying is nonsense. It's this very confusing Ouroboros sort of thing, but he sells it so well. And his scenes might be among my favorites of this movie.
They are really good. This whole sequence is great, where he kind of sneaks into the bowels of the Scientology building. And he finds those people chanting nothing exists, nothing is nothing, staring at that blank, poster from the girl's room.
Yeah, it's a recording where it's nothing that exists can be understood. Even if it could be understood, it couldn't be explained. Even if it was explained, it couldn't be communicated. You know, it's this weird circular logic thing of these people just muttering in front of a poster.
But what's specifically great about that is that, so the speech that Stephen Root was giving, the end of it is that all repetition robs meaning, and repeating mm-hmm. anything takes away the meaning. The next thing you see is them repeating the same phrases to themselves. They're like, oh, that's a nice little thing there.
Yeah.
He sees them doing a bottle blowing into experiment in the basement of the place. And I cannot love more how this pays off at the end of the movie. So he's there and he makes a noise, in quotes, he makes noise. And they stop and go, is someone here? Does someone want to communicate with us? And he's like, stop, not doing anything. And they move on with the experiment they're doing. And leave it there, because I don't want to spoil it. If anybody's listening, let's keep the... But I love that setup. And then the lights turn on and they're like, you need to come with us. Like, just the suit people.
Yeah, which there is apparently... I have not paused to look, but the director was saying that in some of those more crowd scenes, because when Stephen Root, after he gives the speech, after the sermon or whatever, James goes over and talks to him, he gives a whole further explanation about like you said, the thing with the repetition, and there's these students in thrall around him just listening, and apparently Amanda's in there. There's a few of these scenes where the director claims that he hit Amanda in some of these shots.
Oh really? Yeah. Oh, that's fun.
But I didn't see it. But this guy I don't love, Garrett. He encounters
Neil Cassidy,
this kid. Yeah. And it's an extremely bizarre choice, and I like it. There's nothing against him for the dialogue, because he meets this kid inside and shows him a picture. It's like, hey, have you seen this girl? And the kid's like, ah, no way. And he's like, he can tell it's bullshit. But he meets him outside. He's like, you don't want to mess with these cats, man. They're real gone, out of this world. I find his face upsetting, and that's not a crew. It's not a good or fair review, but his face bothers me.
All right, so there's a lot going on here. One, this was a bit of evidence, and again, led me down the wrong path. I understand cults weird. I'm from San Francisco. And San Francisco is a massive hub of the Beat Generation. Neil Cassidy is like, he's basically the guy that Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road about. He's Dean Moriarty is Neil Cassidy. That's his actual name. So when he goes, you're doing the Neil Cassidy routine, this just led into my, oh, this is like a literary thing. This is a reference point. But I would just like to say that kid sucks at acting. Because I thought he was just doing a dumb, like, fine, you're doing a dumb accent. But later in the movie, when he, like, kind of drops the accent and goes into, like, real stuff, like, he does this fake laugh later in the movie, which is the worst fake laugh I've ever heard in my life. Yeah, he's not good. It's one of the few, like, actual, like, yeah, that's just a red, that's a red mark on that. Like, yeah, that's a red X, sorry. Like, you're not going to lose the A because he's in it, but, yeah, maybe you could have waited for like the next guy down the list of, you know.
Yeah, it's actors. It's one of the few marks on the paper is this for sure.
Speaking of which, Neil Cassidy hips him to camp where all the fucking weird shit goes down.
Yeah, I forget what the acronym is, but it's like, you know, that's where they go to pre-process them.
And he finds his name in a red file, which is creepy, and the red file is empty.
Camp Elsewhere, it's called. It's this abandoned camp, and going through, all their files and recognizes people's names. Like he gets Amanda Quayle and picks out Devara's name and someone else. And then he sees one that's Jay LaSombra and he opens it up and it's empty. And his reaction here again, like, is great where he's like, okay, that's weird. But just, it didn't feel like, well, that happened. It felt like a very sort of natural response. And
no, they play his encountering strange very well. Yeah.
It's funny because it seems like he's constantly surrounded by weirdos, and he is, but then there's the other side of it that we learn later. If you want to follow that interpretation, that makes his performance even better. But yeah. So then he goes to there's another cabin there.
There is nothing creepier than a teddy bear moving on its own accord.
Yes.
A teddy bear moving in the background is fucking creepy. I don't care what happens. Because first you see its arm move and I like, yeah, fuck you. That's scary. But then the teddy bear's gone, which even more scary. But he watches. Yeah, sorry.
The way they frame it, because like he finds the stack of old videotapes and he's watching them. And you could the way that the shot is composed is there's the doorway behind him and they have already done a close up on the teddy bear. So, you know, OK, there's a teddy bear there. What's going on with that thing? And it's blurry behind him in the distance. And the way that the camera is framed, you're like, something's going to happen. Something's going to happen. And then it waits to the close-up to have him move again. But then you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen now? And it really builds that tension very effectively.
Super creepy. And those VHSs are great. They're doing like a Philip experiment type thing, which I don't have the time to go into. But if you're like a paranormal person, you know what the Philip experiment is. And then you see like this naked fucking crazy guy like ripping his own intestines out and then painting like this man sitting in lotus stylized thing on the wall.
Yeah, it's the logo of the Pontifex.
It turns out that's the logo. And then James flips his flashlight up and looks at the wall and it's right there. And he's like, oh, fuck, I'm in the room.
Yeah.
Totally fucking cool. Totally creepy. And then did we go to the weird outside bonfire thing?
Yes, because so this I want to say real quick because I went off about it in Malignant. This is if not VHS, old video done right, I think, because you get the sense the frame rate's different, the way the you know, the infrared stuff.
Yeah, I thought this looked good. Yeah,
it's very effective and makes it seem like otherworldly and creepy rather than being obviously like the same camera, but we just put some scan lines over it. But so he's been there watching these videos long enough that it is now nighttime. And he encounters this crowd of people circling this flame. I have no idea what they're saying, but they're chanting.
Let me throw something out here. So when he drives up into the camp, I said, oh, this is like a Bohemian Grove kind of thing, which is like where the Illuminati meet up in Northern California. And one of the things they do there is called the cremation of care ceremony, which they gather in front of this giant stone owl of Moloch, the Hebrew devil kind of thing. And then they do this ceremony called the cremation of care, but it involves this giant bonfire. So when he rolled into this backwoods thing, I'm like, oh, they're obviously doing a Bohemian Grove kind of thing. Then they do this giant fire ceremony. It's like, oh, fuck, this is totally like a Bohemian Grove kind of thing. And then shit goes fucking weird.
Yes.
And it's not a Bohemian Grove kind of thing. It's actual fucking magic.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't know exactly what happens in that moment, but all of a sudden he's staring at the fire. It goes super bright. The stars get all weird. And then he kind of snaps to and
Well, then the fire goes out, which is actually almost as creepy as the fire going super to the sky. And then these black clad figures start walking in sync and then see him turn and start chasing him. And it's like, this is scary as shit.
It's that's one of the most genuinely like terrifying moments of the movie. He's able to escape, but it's a really great sequence.
This is what I was thinking of before about him being like a relatable person. When their steps are mimicked, he goes, yeah, no.
Yeah.
And just starts walking away. And when afterwards, he peels out of his car, gets like the people chasing him, breaking his windows. He gets away far enough, stops the car, goes, what the fuck was that? Yeah. I love that. That is so fucking relatable. Cause like, it's not, he's been finding out some weird shit. Nothing's been demonstrably proven yet, but he just saw some legit weirdness. He just saw a fire in the sky, people chasing him. What the fuck was that? Yeah. Like, well, I think,
cause it's like, those also aren't played for laughs. Like, it's not like, this is genuinely like that guy being like, oh, fuck this. Like, that's, I mean, you might get a laugh out of it, but it's not like, you know, winky winky. It's his genuine reaction of like, fuck, this is bad. Yeah. And yeah, same thing afterwards. Cause what the fuck was that? What just happened? And again, I think James Badge Dale, sells that really, really well.
That's James.
That is James. The actor's name is James Badge Dale.
Well, that's easy for him to remember.
Yeah. I would like that. I wonder if you can get to a point in your career where you are like, look, I'm tired of playing people with other names. Whatever your character is, if I'm going to be in the movie, you're naming it John. Like, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to try to be a Dave.
Yeah, you can pull off Dave.
I
have full faith in your acting prowess.
That means a lot. I can't, but I don't think I could do a Dave.
He gets back, finds out he's being chased by the Pontifex following him because they drop a teddy bear at his doorbell. His doorbell at his doorstep.
Yeah, well, he's woken up again at 3:03 a.m.
Oh, he must be lonely.
Yeah.
Because sometimes
because
I believe it.
Nope.
Is. Yeah.
Don't make me go smooth.
Okay. Yeah, please.
Well, just at this point, like he's really starting to, things are starting to get really weird. And he's starting to kind of have some more like hallucinations. Like one of the particular ones I like is after he goes to the hospital, which we're not there yet, but like when he's driving around and it's the cityscape, like it cuts and you can see like the hospital outside the inside of the hospital outside his window. It's very strange.
Oh yeah.
But I like that scene a lot, but yeah, he starts, cause he follows a bunch of the kids to the hospital. He starts tracking Neil Cassidy, that Neil Cassidy kid, and follows him.
No, that happens afterwards.
After the
First, he talks to Amanda's mom, and they run away together because he realizes that Pontifex is after them after being chased.
Oh, right.
Away from the campground. So him and that lady book it. He puts her in a motel, and then he finds that creepy teddy bear at his door, and then the next day. He follows Neil Cassidy because that's where the only reason I know this because I have day three written down because I thought that might be important. Turns out it wasn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was the ticking clock, but he follows his kids to the hospital and finds out that they all go and visit this weird comatose man who you discover is Paul from the first from the Bhutan sequence.
Oh, yeah. Are we sure about that?
Yes.
Okay, I'm confused by this because I thought that's what we're referencing, but the nurse lady says that he's been bounced around hospitals for, I guess 25 years is enough time for all those hospitals to be bounced around. Okay.
He's got the same stupid little earring and like he's very badly, you know, decimated from being a conduit apparently, but.
Totally. I thought that's what they were going with, but I didn't realize it was like explicitly. Yeah, you're probably right. I think it's. Because I feel old, 25 years doesn't feel like enough time from 95 to like that. Just my head won't accept
right.
that 25 years from 1995 to now could possibly age a person that much. Because that was 10 years ago. I don't know if you know that.
Right. Yeah. No, the Super Mario Brothers movie just came out as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. but this is where you really start getting the because then after that, he stalks and ends up kidnapping the Neil Cassidy kid. And that's where you're starting to get the, like, things really start getting trippy because he starts talking about how his, you know, the Neil Cassidy kid kind of drops the act and is like, you know, these people, you know, this is a much more big thing than you even realize. You can feel your brain itch now and that the dude that you saw was a conduit for the empty man or, you know, it's starting to get really, like, metaphysical and cosmic horror-y around here.
And he breaks into Pontifex to try to figure out what's going on. And there's some good... creepy horror stuff, but the one and the little things in this movie is what sells it is that like a window just opens behind him on his way in.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just these little tiny like, oh, it makes me feel fucking uncomfortable. But he gets into Pontifex and there's a fun like somewhat joke where he brings bolt cutters, but it turns out the gates just open.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's stupid, but I found it amusing.
No, it's great.
And he finds another he finds the red folder, but this time all of his info's in it. There's a picture of him like strapped to a chair, nude.
Yeah,
it is quite weird.
Well, yeah. And then there's excerpts about growing up in San Francisco because by this time he said it like three times,
yes.
And like it gets increasingly forced. The first time you're like, oh, ha ha ha. Second time's like, okay, this joke's pushing it. The third time it's like, this doesn't even make sense. But then you kind of understand, you eventually come to understand again with the themes of repetition in this movie that like, it's almost like he's trying to believe it himself.
He figures out like, oh, I'm involved, whatever. So he goes to the hospital where the conduit is. He talks to the nurse lady there and she's like, this man was at Bellevue 23 years ago. He moved to this. You know, blah, blah, blah. We're, you know, kind of getting backstory. I think that's to prove that it's Paul and I'm just dumb and didn't get it. And she's like, oh, well, there's actually someone in there right now with him. And we pan up and it's fucking Amanda. It's she's Amanda. Right there. It's the person we've been looking through for this whole fucking movie. She's there. And she explains this whole thing. The carrier is both a signal and disease. You know, it's all metaphysical rigmarole and... I don't really know what sequence happens. He tries to call Laura and she doesn't know who the fuck he is.
Well, yeah, because basically, yeah, she's like, well, he calls Nora and is like, hey, I found your daughter. And the person on the other end is like, I don't know who this is. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And Amanda starts telling him that, well, yeah, turns out, guess what, buddy? You're a tulpa. We made you up. What is the, I forget what the thing is in the word, but it's like concentration plus time. Plus equals thought flesh equals flesh. Like and it's like, yeah, that we did that. Which like, well, you think I didn't know about your dalliance with my mom? I wrote that in there.
I love that. Yeah, she said I wrote it into your script when I created you.
Yeah, because we need to have someone that has like sadness and terror for the empty man to like to really grasp on. That's why it's never worked. And it's been like it was 500 years for the last carrier before Paul, and now Paul. So we thought we'd maybe try to make our own. And this is where it gets really weird because you could like there's an argument to be made that they've just like fucked with him so much and his brain is just so crazy that the guilt's there too and they've broken him down so he just wants to believe this or it actually is true. Like there's I can't get a grasp on this.
But here's the one of the kind of important runners is that he was taking an antipsychotic or some kind of medicine through the whole movie.
It's an it's an antidepression help you sleep thing.
And as the movie goes on, he stops taking it.
Yeah. At the start of day three, right after the teddy bear thing, he stops taking it.
So there's the question of whether, but her saying I wrote it in your script is like, oh, that's why all those literary references.
Uh-huh.
God damn it. I should have like that was the moment of, I picked up on so many fucking subtle clues and it led me down the wrong path and it's annoying because I don't think I picked up on the clues you were supposed to. I picked up on the actual ones and I'm a fucking moron.
But the two things she gives to him about like, well, like what high school did you go to? Where were you born? Like those are things you can find out. You know what I mean? Like that, those aren't like big, like, oh, who do you love? Oh, the who's your favorite Beatle? It's Ringo. I wrote that it's Ringo.
I think, doesn't she say you were fucking my mom while your wife died or something
there,
like
there's something, that? There's something that goes know. a little bit deeper, but yeah. I mean, there is some of that. But this is what I was talking about earlier. So at the end, like, he's kind of like thrashing around and having this thing. And she's like, wouldn't it be, you know, all this time you thought that you're your own man, but you're not, you're our man. And isn't that what you want? Wouldn't it be better to just let go? And while she's telling this, like, it looks like she's about to cry.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like this, like, oh, I'm so happy that like, this is all I've wanted is for this to work. And it's worked. It feels like this genuine sorrow for him or something like, I can't get a grip on it. And I feel like there is something there. This isn't just like a mistake or something that doesn't work with somebody else.
Absolutely.
But like,
this movie's too well constructed for that.
It's just like, I'm sure it's there. I'm just not getting it, but that makes it work, you know?
So here's where some questions happen. All right. So after this happened, he sees the cloak thing coming after him. He sees himself at the meeting from earlier, but now he's at the bottom of the meeting looking at himself interrupt. And then that makes sense to when they're like, oh, are you here? Where they're actually hearing other him, which is like, oh, I love this. There's actually a scene in Periphery that does this exact same thing. Sorry, I keep talking about it. There's so much fucking Periphery.
Everyone read
movie.
That book. But it's weird because, yeah, at this point, like, reality is really just sort of is crumbling. Like, there is really no way to know the timeline of what's happening or what exactly is happening, because he'll, like, walk out of doors and end up, you know, halfway across town. When he ends up going back home and his house is completely empty. Which is either like, was he ever there at all? Because he has to like break in. It's like, was he ever there at all? Or did the cult take all his stuff? I don't know. But then it ends up with him back in the hospital.
Wait, before that. Yeah, because there's like a couple things I want to say before that. There's a scene where he sees himself being chased by the cloak thing, and the cloak thing vomits into his mouth.
Well, see, now this is where it gets like really Lovecraftian. Because first of all, I just want to speak to how subtle the effects are in this movie, because like you talked about with the poster, like kind of seeing something moving in there. It's very subtle. But this, he at a certain point, he's transported back to that hallway that he's seen, and apparently like he sees himself in the chair, sitting nude in the chair in the file folder. And at the back of it, for a moment, he gets transported to Bhutan, whereas there's the thing standing there, and then like
he sees the multi-arm thing.
And then the wall goes, and then like the wall kind of goes in front of it, sort of fades back behind the wall, and you start to see it move behind the wall. Which is great in the like almost Jaws sense of like, if we saw that thing move and do that stuff, it probably would look pretty stupid. But because you obfuscated it, it's so much more creepy. And when it passes through the veil, that's the rags that are on it. And that is so cool. I love that so much.
But him seeing that kind of adds to the he's not insane narrative. Because he would never know about Bhutan. Mm. Unless all the Bhutan thing is something he invented in his own mind, but...
Right. I mean, yeah, that would have to be. Yeah, I have no idea how he would know about that. But yeah, but then the thing chases him, gets him down and like pulls off the shroud. And it ends up being this like tentacle faced thing, which is very much like, I'm going to fuck up this name. Nyarthotep, I think is what it is. There's a Lovecraft old one or one of those guys that looks like that.
Wasn't the idea of all those old ones that you can't pronounce it with the human tongue or your fucking mouth would explode?
Basically,
so,
yeah. I think that's basically, yeah. I know that's Cthulhu's thing, but I think, whatever. There's probably some racism involved too. But it vomits this stuff into his mouth and is like, all right, I did that. That's great. And then after that, he ends up back at the hospital in Paul's room, shoots Paul through his third eye, by the way, creating the Pontifex logo behind him with a splatter of blood. And then just like,
I didn't notice the logo behind him. That's cool.
Then finishes murdering him and turns around and all the hospital staff is there and they drop to their knees in front of him, which is funny because so this movie took so long to get made. I was reading an interview with David Pryor where he's like, and then I saw Hereditary and I'm like, fuck. Cause it's, it has this kind of similar ending.
Yeah.
And he's like, and it's like a well-made movie and everything. It's not just like, oh, these jerks, they did the thing I was going to do. Like, they put in a really good movie. Fuck.
That's funny.
Now everyone's going to think I ripped them off or something. But so it's a similar idea in that sense. Yeah. But yeah, it's different because it's also like, I'm not clear what any of this means now. So let's say he's the next conduit. Like he's not paralyzed like Paul was by being the carrier or whatever. Is he actually the empty man because he's created from nothing that this thing went into? Whatever it is not good, but I don't, it's not like the end of Hereditary. It's like, well, this guy's a demon and he's the prince of hell and he's back now. Oh shoot.
Yeah.
Because this whole thing is also about how like how Parsons gives this whole speech about the things losing meaning because of repetition and like actually imbuing those things with meaning again, like the, what does it mean to look into abyss or whatever? So it's kind of like these people are almost it's relevant for now because it's sort of like this fight for the truth of like, these people want to be able to shape what these things mean.
Yeah.
And like, if they're able to control, have this otherworldly power that like gets to control what these things mean and actually like therefore control life that way, that's a whole other element to it. But I thought that was kind of like a deliciously satirical kind of element to this.
Yeah. I just thought the empty man was like, he was like a little hangry and like, just probably what it was. Need to get some food. Yeah.
They fly now.
I got nothing else about this movie.
Yeah. Just describing it really doesn't do it justice. And I mean, there's so much here and so much of it, like I said before, is a movie to be experienced. Like it fucks with your mind in wonderful ways.
Yes.
And deserves, I think, multiple viewings. And it's 137 minutes, and I think it's worth all that time. He would have possibly cut 6 minutes out of it, but I don't know what that would be. And I'm fine with it as it is. I think, like, it's not 100%. Like, it doesn't all completely coalesce for me, but it's amazing that this exists. It's a really audacious movie, and that's enough for me to look over a lot of that.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Like, totally watch it. Really enjoyed it. There are parts that I thought dragged a bit, but, like, overall, it's so good that, like, I don't even feel like bringing that up is, like, to be overly critical for no good reason. It's totally a worthwhile watch. I would say, like, honestly, if I want to say fucking Citizen Kane, there's parts where it's like, yeah, come on, pick up the fucking pace. But it's Citizen Kane. Don't talk about it. This is a beautiful, weird-ass movie that shouldn't exist and does. Shut up about the weird fucking and I think, tiny criticisms.
But yeah, I think you do need to give yourself over to it to a certain degree of, like, like I said, like, if you really start, like, trying to piece together, well, then how would they have known, whatever? I think you're missing the forest for the trees, or whatever the phrase
is. Mark Twain National Forest.
For the Mark Twain National Trees.
No, that's the Samuel Clemens trees, you dumb fuck. All right. Hey, look at you. I'm Crowley at Bolskin House, but I don't even know where Mark Twain is.
Crowley and Bolskin House?
Yeah, I'm just making dumb references. That's the name of the weird house on Loch Ness that he did the Abramelin ritual in. And then that guy from Led Zeppelin eventually purchased it.
Oh.
Abramelin ritual, you might know. There's this movie called The Dark Song. I don't know if you ever saw it. You'd like it.
I do. I almost watched that the other day.
Oh yeah, good.
But the
we should do an episode on that one.
That would probably be pretty good. I don't know. I'll listen to the one that we did and see if it's worth doing.
Okay, fair enough.
But
now I'm doing the opposite joke of. I mean, I guess it's the same joke if I don't remember the show. But now I'm like, I'm so committed to it that I.
we've both trapped ourselves in our realities, in our competing realities.
All right. So recommendations, John. I'm going to start because I have one.
Excellent.
I watched Netflix's Squid Game. I have a very specific recommendation. Is if you have a Netflix account, I want you to cancel it immediately and spend the rest of your billing cycle watching Wachowski and other trans filmmakers so their bandwidth goes up and they get no money out of you. Because Netflix pretty much went on record and said, we're okay with TERFs.
Yep.
And they're a shit heel company. However, I already paid them for this month and I watched The Squid Game, which was very good if you're willing to fast forward at times. There's times in that show where you get the feeling, do I really need to see this? You're right. Just go ahead and fast forward through it. There's nothing that you're going to miss. You're totally fine. But the overall experience, outside of the platform, very good.
Watch a homebrew edit of The Squid Game.
I mean, it's not even that many times, but there's some stuff that is just like, it's pretty obvious that, like, this isn't going to be important to the plot. Just go ahead. Just fast forward. The lead in it, I don't know the actor's name, but he's got that it factor. I hate that phrase, but
no,
like,
but I know you
want to look at him.
Like,
he's got a face and you're just like, I like watching this guy do stuff. Like, I don't even care what it is. So anyway,
you got the goods.
Don't sign up for Netflix for the Squid Game. Cause I'm really annoyed at that fucking statement. That was kind of a bullshit thing to say. I'm not even all that against, like, I'm more upset with Netflix's response to Dave Chappelle than I am Dave Chappelle saying the TERF thing.
Yeah, well,
because you're allowed to have a shitty opinion, but if you run a company going, oh no, we definitely support that shitty opinion, that's worse.
Well, it's not just that they support the shitty opinion, it's that they will do censorship of other things for certain things.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
then
totally,
claim
yeah,
that,
yeah.
No, we're all about the artist, which,
yeah,
come on.
So fuck that company. Yeah. Don't give them extra money. Try to cancel if you can. But if you've got, say, 30 days left on your billing cycle, go ahead and watch Squid Game. Totally good. Don't give them extra money if you have to. Once you're done with Squid Game, turn on a trans filmmaker, watch that movie over and over again, set up one of those I drink water birds to move your mouse every now and again, so Netflix thinks you're still watching. Waste their bandwidth. Make sure it's at 4K. And yes.
Yeah, like, if I don't know if Jupiter Ascending's on there, but that's the only time I'd recommend watching Jupiter Ascending.
Yeah. I mean, don't actually watch it, you know, because, But anyway, yeah, that's my recommendation. Ascending. Yeah.
Mine would be, I'm kind of like you, I'm a little bit at a loss. I've been in a lot of rewatching of horror movies I've liked before. So it's not like a lot of new exciting things. I rewatched A Field in England, which I always enjoyed. That's a real, like, other sort of mind trip of a movie that I don't think has a full explanation, and I'm fine with it.
That's by somebody that did something else, right?
It's by Ben Wheatley, who did Kill List, which is another great sort of folk horror movie. High Rise, which I did not enjoy. I really only enjoy Kill List and Field in England. His other output, what I've seen, I haven't enjoyed. He's got a new one that's on Hulu right now called like In the Earth, I think, that I haven't yet watched. But High Rise, I didn't enjoy. He did a remake of Hitchcock's Rebecca, which I don't fully understand why you would do that, but whatever. Yeah, so that's good. And then I had the opportunity for the first time ever to see The Wicker Man, the good one, at the theater.
The Nicolas Cage one?
No, the original Robin Hardy.
The Nicolas Cage one is infinitely better than the original.
Absolutely not. The Nicolas Cage one is so hateful and misogynistic. And like, I remember when I saw the first one originally, I was like, this is a movie for people that think folk music is scary. And then seeing it again some years later, I'm like, oh man, folk music is fucking terrifying.
Yeah, I like the Nicolas Cage one so much better.
Oh, it's so bad.
It's not a better Cage movie, but it's so much better to watch.
It's Nicolas Cage being great, but like as far as a movie goes, I think this one is way better. And is one of the quintessential folk horror movies. I was thinking about. I ended up watching a lot of folk horror this time around, so I think I was going to do a little solo fast blast of a lot of those. So there's a preview of a couple of the ones I'll talk about, I guess.
So John, next episode, now that we're out of Alex is afraid of the spoopy movies.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go back to the well of non spoopy movies and watch, not our first Quentin Tarantino.
That's correct.
Oh yeah. We did the World War II one, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So this time we're going to watch, Fast Times at Hollywood Times. What's the name? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, Dudes Rock, the movie.
I don't know what that means. I mean, I know what those words mean, but I haven't seen the movie. All I know is that apparently, like a white stuntman beats up Bruce Lee, and everybody was real mad about that.
People get mad about a lot of things.
I hadn't noticed. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for next time. Make sure to sign up on our Patreon because we're pumping out content. Patreon.com/AlexBolin. That's just a legacy URL. It's all Jaws content, pretty much. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Jaws Pod, Facebook, John and Alex Hate Stuff, and rate, review, subscribe if you haven't already, because that actually helps the show, because we do it for free. You'll notice we don't do ads, so you can pay back those minutes of your lives and you don't have to listen to us talk about Tushy or that weird CBD one I hear about shows lately. Yeah.
I thought you were actually talking about actual butts.
No, there's like a bidet or wipes or something called Tushy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so that's it. I've been Alex. That's been John. Yeah. And together, we've been Jaws. That's going to be the new outro.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm never going to do that again. All right, bye.
Bye.